Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Michael Renendez, who has been covering the Boston bombings from the beginning and the dynamics of the Sanarev family since. We will look into the three college classmates of Joker Sanarev who were charged today with hindering the investigation by destroying evidence and making false statements. Then we will assess how much Tom Wheeler, President Obama's nominee to head up the FCC, will be a champion of the public interest or an advocate for corporate control, as his professional background as a lobbyist for the telecommunications industry would suggest. Timothy Carr, the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press, joins us to discuss the critical issues before the new FCC chairman that will determine the future of the public's free access to the Internet and whether the public interest will be asserted over increasingly dominant corporate influence. Then finally, the Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, Winona Horta, joins us for an update on the so-called Monsanto Protection Act that was inserted as a rider in the recently passed continuing resolution to keep the government funded. We'll look into the extraordinary political clout of the food giants that Winona has written about in her new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. And joining us now is the Boston Globe's investigative reporter, Michael Resendez, who has been covering the Boston bombing since it happened and has also been covering the dynamics of the Sanarev family. And he received a Pulitzer Prize in 2003 for his coverage of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and in 2007 was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. But today there was an arraignment of a couple of students, fellow classmates of the younger Sanarev, who are from Kazakhstan, and another American citizen, Robel Filipos, was also accused of lying to investigators. What's your sense of the culpability of these three? Are they charged with covering up, or do they have any involvement at all with the actual bombing and the planning of it?
So far, it looks like they had no involvement whatsoever with the actual planning of the bombing or the laying out of the bombs on Boylston Street near the finish line. It looks like all three of them essentially are being charged with trying to cover up Jakar's involvement in the bombing. And it looks like the two fellows from Kazakhstan played a more active role in doing that, whereas the American citizen, Robel, looks like he played a more passive role. His role is not quite as clear as the other two.
But the other two actively destroyed evidence, did they not?
Yeah, the other two actively took some objects from Jakar's dormitory room. There was a backpack that had some explosives in it and some other items, and they also took his laptop. It's not clear exactly why they took the laptop. One of them said that they were trying to make it look natural and not like a theft. So it's not clear that the laptop has any information on it that would shed any light on the bombing. It's really, so far anyway, the backpack that I think is the focus of the investigators, which did have some evidence of the bombing in it.
So, Michael Resendez, did these two from Kazakhstan, the two college classmates of the younger Boston bomber, did they know that he had done the bombing when they did this? Because there was some texting going on between them, was there not? And they did see him after the bombing.
Yeah, according to the federal charging documents, they did know that he was the Marathon bomber, and they did know that there were fatalities and many people injured when they helped their friend take these materials out of his dormitory room and try to essentially destroy them. So they did have some idea of what they were doing. I mean, these are 19-year-old guys. I think their primary motivation was probably to help a friend and a guy that they liked a lot. But they should have been aware of what he was involved in, and the fact that, that as I said, there were these three fatalities and hundreds injured.
But apparently when the FBI released the pictures of the two brothers, before anybody knew their identity, one of these roommates from Kazakhstan texted Jokar Sanayev to say that he resembled the suspect. And Sanayev responded by texting the phrase LOL, which means laughed out loud. You better not text me. Isn't that pretty incriminating?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a little cryptic as well.
Sure.
It's not clear exactly what it means, but as I said, I think that the two fellows from Kazakhstan did know that Zhikar was one of the Marathon bombers and had been involved in something pretty horrific, and yet they went ahead and helped their friend take these materials out of his dorm room and destroy them, which is essentially destroying evidence of a terrible crime.
And they've been held, what, for about a week, have they not, by the INS for some problem with their student visa?
Yeah, apparently they exceeded their legal stay. I think both the student visas had actually expired, and they were being held on those violations the past week. And actually, they had a hearing in immigration court at 7 o'clock this morning. We had a reporter there. So, yes, they've been held on immigration violations, but now, of course, the charges are much, much more serious, and they're also formal.
And again, I'm speaking with the Boston Globe's investigative reporter, Michael Resendez, who's been covering the Boston bombing since it happened and has been doing a lot of reporting on the dynamics of the Sanara family after the bombings. And as it happens, Michael, a good friend of mine, I talked to him the other day, he's a former very senior official in the CIA, who used to be the station chief in Kabul, and I called him up to talk to him about the CIA giving bags of money to Karzai, and completely unrelated. And he said, "Oh, I'm having the worst time." He said, "There's crazy conspiracy theorists in the press are onto me because my oldest daughter married the uncle of the Sanara brothers, the very fellow that's come out and denounced his nephews as losers."
Oh, wow.
And, of course, needless to say, the conspiracy theorists are connecting the dots as they do, whether they make any sense whatsoever, that somehow now the CIA's fingerprints are all over this damn thing. So,
boy,
you can't make this stuff up, you know.
It's true. And, you know, part of the reason I think you can't make it up is because although we don't know if there was any outside help that was given to the Tsarnaev brothers, but more and more, this looks like an act of homegrown terrorism and perpetrated by some young people who weren't all that bright. So sometimes as we try to ascribe logic to their motivations and try to figure out why they did what they did, it's quite possible that they just simply weren't being logical at times.
And do you think these three that have been arraigned today fit into that category? They're just not too bright?
It does look that way, yeah. I mean, you know, when you take a look at the Tsarnaev brothers, after their photographs were revealed to the world, it doesn't seem like they had much of a plan at all to get away. They didn't have any money. They only had one gun. They end up killing an MIT police officer, and they failed to get his gun out of the holster, so they killed the guy for nothing. And then they spent a couple of hours driving around Brighton, which is a neighborhood in Boston, and Watertown and Waltham, somewhat aimlessly for a couple of hours before the shootout. So, I do think that these fellows, at some level, appear to just not be too bright.
And Michael Resendez, tell me about what you've discovered about the family dynamics. I mentioned the uncle who very quickly made himself available to the press and had a press conference where he denounced his nephews as losers and how they had blackened the family name and blackened the entire Chechen ethnicity. He, and of course, as I mentioned, just by coincidence, he happened to be married, 20 years ago. They've been subsequently divorced for 20 years to the daughter of a friend of mine. But tell me, though, what have you learned about the actual family? Because obviously the parents are in Chechnya, or actually in Dagestan.
They're in Dagestan, yeah.
Yeah, but there is the wife in Rhode Island, and there are two sisters as well, are there not?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I guess what strikes me is how different the brothers are, in the sense that the younger brother, who arrived in the United States at a much younger age, probably about 8 years old, and went to a grammar school before getting into high school, the younger brother seems to have assimilated much more successfully. He was a very, very popular student at Cambridge Ringen Latin High School. He had lots of friends. He played a lot of pickup basketball and went to a lot of parties. And he was also an honor society student who got a scholarship to go to UMass Dartmouth. And in a lot of ways, he seemed like a kid who had a lot going for him. On the other hand, the older brother seems to be somewhat the opposite. I mean, he came to America as a teenager, probably about 16 years old, more difficult age, and he seems to have been a lot less successful at living in the United States. I mean, for instance, the guy really didn't have a job. I mean, at times he described himself as a driver on his marriage application, and his aunt said that at times he was delivering pizza. But for the most part, this is a guy who had no visible means of support. He attended a community college part-time for 3 semesters, and that was it. He was a fairly accomplished amateur boxer, but he never made any money for it, and it didn't look like he ever would make any money for it. So this is a guy who really was a bit at sea and a bit lost. And meantime, he had gotten married and had a three-year-old daughter, and really had no way to support her, and really had no place in the world for himself that he could see before he latched on to this radical form of Islam. So the brothers, I think, are quite different in striking ways, and it does appear that the younger brother came under the influence of the older brother, somewhat tragically, in the absence of their parents.
But the younger brother, given of what he did and how much he was a sort of good soldier along with his older brother, and he doesn't seem to be, I mean, there are varying reports on the extent to which he's cooperating. Apparently he asked for his Miranda rights and lawyers fairly consistently, and it's difficult to know exactly what's going on there. But I get the impression that the brainwashing, if that's the case, from the older brother, looks like it worked.
Yeah, it does look like it worked. And what is really so striking, and we have a young guy who works in our sports department here at the Globe, who graduated from high school with Jahar, and he just can't believe that Jahar would have done anything like this. And I think that's been the reaction from most people who knew him, because unlike other individuals who've been involved in some of the recent mass shootings, the Newtown, Connecticut shooting, for instance, the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, and Tucson, Arizona, these were all perpetrated by guys who were considered to be strange, oddballs, loners. And Jahar is strikingly different. This is a guy who is very sociable, not a loner at all, very popular, very well-liked. And yet he's also shown us that he had absolutely no conscience whatsoever. I mean, after the bombings, he went back to the UMass Dartmouth campus and just picked up life where he had left off, going to the gym to work out, going to his dorm room. We think he might have went to a party with some soccer players. It's rather incredible.
So what do we know about the parents, though? I mean, you mentioned the absence of the parents allowed the older brother to become a kind of surrogate parent and influence the younger brother. But the parents themselves, the mother was arrested for shoplifting. Apparently, they took tremendous amounts of government programs, up to $100,000+ worth of programs, from that I understand, along with food stamps and other things. So what was their story coming here to the United States?
Well, their story is also, like the older brothers, I think, a bit troubled. I mean, they did get divorced. There was clearly friction between the two of them. And like the older brother, it appears that neither of them ever settled into a good job or a reliable, comfortable routine here in the United States. As you said, the mother was arrested for shoplifting at one time before her own deepening fealty to Islam. She was giving facials in her apartment and that sort of thing. The father worked as a mechanic in a garage for a while and then went out on his own, but not because he was successful enough to buy his own garage. What he did is he got permission from the owner of a rug shop to work in an alley behind the rug shop, just repairing the cars of people who heard about him and would take their cars over to the alleyway. So neither of the parents were very successful, and because of their divorce, one surmises that the household was a little bit unstable, at least when the two brothers were growing up there.
And the sisters, did you get any access to them, or have you talked to them?
I have not talked to either of the sisters, and the other media have interviewed them, I think, very, very briefly. They appear to have been eager to leave, and there isn't much that is known about them. I think one of them have a drug record, but there's very little that's known about them.
I see. And what are the chances of either of the parents showing up here in the United States? I believe that the widow of the older brother did sign off on having the body collected of her late husband.
Yeah, that's correct. But I think it's going to be the uncle you mentioned who's down in Maryland. I think those are the people who are going to take possession of the body. I think the parents' trip, as I understand it, back to the United States has been delayed. I'm not sure what the reason is. I do know that the father, Anzor, has diagnosed with cancer at one time, and he may feel that his health is not good enough for him to travel to the States. But in any event, my understanding is the body will be claimed by the relatives that are now in Maryland.
And the mother may not be coming because Russian intelligence have indicated that they've intercepted phone calls with her and her older son that indicate that she may have helped in his radicalization.
Yeah, there is some indication of that. I'm sure you saw her press conference from Dagestan. I mean, she was clearly distraught and grief-stricken and a bit hysterical. So,
and in denial, too.
And in denial, exactly. So I'm not sure she'd be able to make a trip to the United States either.
Right. Well, since this has happened in your city and you've been covering it, Margaret Resendez again, Boston Globe's investigative reporter, when are we going to put this past us? Because one of the things I find so extraordinary about this is the low price of terrorism but the high cost. In other words, you know, it's like going back to the box cutters that took down all these planes and these buildings. And in this case, a couple of amateurs causing such mayhem and shutting down a major American city for almost a week. That part of it I find extraordinary. We're told that asymmetrical warfare may well be haunting us for decades, but you've experienced it firsthand. What are the lessons, and how's the city coming back?
Well, the city's coming back just fine. I mean, the city has shown a remarkable spirit that is at the same time generous, determined, and tough. Immediately after the bombings, I think as President Obama noted, people were going to Fenway Park without a second thought. There are joggers out all over the city. As someone who ran the Boston Marathon this year and has run it several times in the past, I can assure you that there'll be a Boston Marathon next year and that there'll be many more to come. So I think the city has really come together in a terrific way. But I think the incident also gives all of us great pause because, as you said, it was so easy to commit these acts of terror. The pressure cooker bombs that the Tsarnaev brothers made could be put together for under $100 a piece with commonly available components. The pressure cooker, I mean, these things are routinely used to cook rice or beans, and, you know, they're stuffed with nails and ball bearings and some gunpowder, and voila, you have a powerful bomb. Virtually anyone could put it together. So I think that's got to give all of us, especially law enforcement, great pause because, in a way, I think, as President Obama also said, that this is even tougher to prevent than a well-financed act of international terror.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Resendez.
Sure, my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Boston Globe's investigative reporter, Michael Resendez. He has been covering the Boston bombing since it happened and has also covered the dynamics of the Tsarnaev family. In 2007, he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a winner of the Public Service Award from the Society of Professional Journalists for the Spotlight Teams. That's the investigative team with the Boston Globe's series on abuses in the debt collection industry. And in addition, he co-authored the book Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church, and was a contributing author to Sins Against the Innocent, Sexual Abuse by Priests, and the Role of the Catholic Church. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into President Obama's choice as the new head of the FCC.